evening and welcome to Stockwatch this Friday. I'm Alicia Seckerman. Joining me via Zoom is independent analyst Ashraf Mohammed and Gary Boyson from Rand Swiss as well. Welcome to you both and thanks so much for joining us this evening. Well, as we digest what Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana delivered yesterday in his midterm budget policy statement address, we've seen economists and analysts for the most part left cautiously satisfied. Bottom line, growth is needed to fund the state's coffers. But while the right tone was struck and all the right things were said, with the path to getting to that growth still unclear, execution risk is underlined. Still, even in this precarious state, Nes Naya says it's worthwhile looking at something in the financial sector. Let's take a listen.
I think it's probably worthwhile looking at something in the financial sector. I'm going to go for First Rand. It's hovering around the 60 Rand level. And I think, you know, as things sort of improve, or sort of the risk dissipates in South Africa to an extent, I think you might see some of the banking shares get even stronger.
Gary, I tied this to budget yesterday because, of course, we know banking stocks are highly correlated to that of economic growth, and we've got to look at it within that context. How are you feeling about the value the financial sector is bringing to the fore at this point?
I think the financial play is probably not a bad way to go. You know, of course, our GDP growth is going to be very constrained going forward. Until we solve the energy crisis in South Africa, you can't really see South Africa growing at 3, 4, 5%, which would be absolutely spectacular for the banks. But I think what our banks have going for them is, one, they're incredibly cheap compared to international peers. At the same time, I think we have to accept that we're moving into a tighter monetary policy environment. So we're going to see interest rates in South Africa starting to rise. And traditionally, that doesn't leave you many sectors in which to invest. It tends to put a bit of the brakes on more growth-orientated stocks. And value stocks like our banks, I think, will come to the fore. And obviously, rising interest rate environments, you don't want to be in, you know, almost bond products. And you get to the what they call the TINA situation. There is nothing else. Or at least there is no alternative. And so I think the banking sector is going to do fairly well. We've seen it they've been quite robust since the coronavirus crash. But yeah, looking at something like First Rand, absolutely, out of all the banks, that is our preferred bank to hold at the moment, and we do hold in local portfolios.
Yeah, is that the cherry you pick in that sector too, Ashraf? First Rand, it seems to be a broad consensus when we talk to our analysts on the show.
Yeah, look, First Rand is definitely a quality play on the South African economy. Also, remembering there's a big portion now that is where they derive their income from the UK. So that act as a hedge for the South African economy. But if you really wanted to play and gear yourself to South African economic growth, then Standard Bank and Nedbank would be others to consider.
Okay, I want to ask you a quick question just on interest rate trajectory, the dot plot locally. Ashraf, what are you pricing in that regard right now?
So I only expect 2 interest rate increases for next year. I don't think the governor can be that aggressive given his dual mandates of inflation management as well as economic growth. And it's the latter one where I think the risk lies. Gary alluded to the load shedding, and I think that's going to hold us back. But not only that, if you speak to the mining companies, and at the moment the mining companies are generating the excess revenue for SARS, unfortunately Transnet's not playing ball and they can't get coal, platinum and other commodities to the ports. So, you know, we need everything to be working properly to get to 5% economic growth.
Absolutely. Well, while that is what stole some of the economic focus this week, we had a bit of company earnings and corporate news filtered through too. Telkom reporting a close to 20% rise in its mobile subscriber base in its half year to the end of September, helping to drive revenue growth and cushion the effects of a continued decline in the group's fixed line business and the pressure being exerted by its IT arm specifically. Telkom's was Chantal Marx's pick this week.
I think the investment case for Telkom is really great. You have the towers business that they're going to unbundle next year that I think will really add value to shareholders. You do have the mobile business growing nicely, even though growth slowed. I don't think it's surprising that growth slowed if you look at the period against which it's measured, which is hard lockdown last year when everyone was on their phones. So I think that you'll see that kind of improving over time. They'll also benefit from spectrum, the spectrum situation becoming more clear, even though they're one of the reasons why it's being held up at the moment. And then it's just cheap. It's the cheapest in the sector. It probably shouldn't be because it still offers you really great growth and some they've got some really cool levers to pull apart from just the tower unbundling.
Gary, I must admit, I wasn't too happy with the CEO of Telkom, Sipho Maseko, this week. He dropped our interview at the last minute, so I didn't actually get to grips with him about what was tabled. Something that does stand out is spectrum allocation, though, because one wants to get a sense of just how much of the growth a player like Telkom has enjoyed over this period as a result of the reprieve these telcos players have been offered over the period, and when that starts to get reined in, what happens next?
No, of course. I mean, spectrum has always been something that's holding back the sector. But at the same time, as Chantal was alluding to, Telkom is one of the cheaper players in the market. And I think, if you look at what's happened in the sector recently, the value players really, when I say the value players, the less aggressively priced companies are really coming to the fore. You look at the share price run that we've seen on MTN over the last year. It's been nothing short of spectacular. Telkom has also done incredibly well off the lows. And I think, they're interesting businesses. So Telkom, they're so entrenched in the way that we do business. They're so entrenched in our lives that there's a good defensive element to any telco company. But of course, you're facing all the risks around that the regulator can throw at them. One ICASA ruling the wrong way and suddenly that makes a material impact to revenue and earning profiles. So there are risks in the sector, of course. But at the same time, you've got to look at the anchor shareholder of something like Telkom and look at it on a longer term play and just look at the kind of inelastic demand for its product. When we went into lockdown, as we move into a digital future, I mean, these companies are absolutely crucial. They're more than utilities. So I like the business. I like both MTN and Telkom at the moment. But I think Telkom, just on the valuation play, probably would top MTN.
Yeah. Ashraf, how are you feeling about Telkom? There's quite a few moving parts in play here because we're anticipating the listing of its tower business. We know that it's looking for a strategic partner to help bolster the IT division right now, even though we've seen what was rumored to be a potential transaction with MTN lapse and fall by the wayside.
Yeah, look, Telkom seems to be looking at potential transactions within its own market, whereas it should look for a strategic partner and a more of a technology partner to allow it to compete with MTN in the South African market. Because, mobile telephony is the last decade story, and it's now about content and abroad and payments, etc. So there's a far broader spectrum of products that they can push through their network, which I don't think they're taking advantage of. They are tinkering to unlock value, mm-hmm. and I think we'll see that process continuing over the next 2 to 3 years, but they need to make a structural shift in the business and, tie up with an AT&T or T-Mobile could be that opportunity for them.
Okay, so we have to watch that space. Another company out with numbers yesterday as well was Sappi, showing a return to profitability for the year ended September, turning a loss of, $135 million in 2020 to a profit of $13 million for 2021. But Dale Hutchison is eyeing Mondi instead.
It's trading on probably close to a 13-time scored multiple. Gives you a rand hedge. It's a quality business. It's in a space where there's structural growth as people transition towards more paper-based packaging. So that's the name I like. And there's still some capex that's going to lead to volume growth, etc., which I'm comfortable with. They're very lucky in that they're an integrated producer. So even you know, cost pressures that clearly are weighing on the sector overall, they're very well positioned to absorb those, and it's going to drive pricing increases, and they're going to be a beneficiary of those pricing increases.
Well, I wasn't very fair there because my intro, Gary, more to do with Sappi than Mondi, but I did it very purposefully because I want to weigh the two up against each other. So what's holding more weight in your books right now?
I think we probably fulfill Mondi out of the two. If you go through Sappi's results yesterday, I mean, really focusing on just the difficulties that they were facing in the South African economy, everything from the labor unrest, which I think prevented just about 100,000 tons of essentially dissolving pulp not passing through the Durban ports. So I think Sappi really highlights and just how difficult the environment is. But looking at Mondi's results, Mondi a little bit more aggressive with the pricing as well. Both companies are suffering just from the massive increase that we've seen in their raw materials cost. And the ability to pass that on to consumers is quite important. And you do get the sense that Mondi is managing to do that a little bit more effectively than Sappi. I hear that it's a growth industry and I hear they benefit from e-commerce, but I mean, you get a package, you kind of think this has got to be at saturation point. There's no way you can put more packaging around a product than you're getting. It's a box in a box in a box with a piece of paper around it. But, on the face of it, yes, you look at something like Alibaba Singles Day, and you look at just the volume of e-commerce, the volume of deliveries that are going around the world. Yes, maybe it isn't a sector that is picking up from a cyclical point of view. But out of the two, yes, Sappi's got a very good graphics paper business that does need to be lifting up. Mondi, I think, it's the largest producer of craft paper. On balance, I'd probably say Mondi was the better way to go.
Yeah, and that's exactly the point, right, Ashraf? It's this volume or invigorated volume scenario that's starting to flow through that people are latching onto at this stage. How are you feeling about Sappi? Do you think that saturation point that Gary's highlighted is still a long way off?
Look, I think Sappi is always going to be subject to fluctuating earnings. It's on the lower end of the value chain when you're looking at paper and packaging. So expect volatile earnings, and this last set of results, was a good indication of that. My preference is Mondi because of its greater global earnings, as well as diversified manufacturing base. And yes, they are better positioned to take advantage of e-commerce. I think Sappi will benefit as commodity prices push higher, especially with the inflation scare globally. So expect them to show another good quarter of earnings or maybe three.
Yeah.
But then you could expect a possible pullback from there.
Okay, I'm going to try and squeeze one more into this segment of the show and stick to the corporate news agenda. RB Plat accepted Northam's 17.2 billion rand unsolicited offer this week, whilst leaving Implats out in the cold. But still, Kamsankwan Nekpa says Impala Platinum is his pick.
I think good balance sheet, good cash flows, although they missed out on the RB Plat transaction, I think they're still in a place where they can continue to acquire quality assets globally. And I think there's lots of room to grow given where the health of their balance sheet is currently.
I'm going to keep this one quick. Gary, if you're looking at an Impala Platinum within that platinum sphere, how are you feeling about it?
Yeah, I think we probably prefer Amplats and Sibanye as platinum plays, and then Sibanye over Amplats as well. But if you look at the PGM basket, it's been in deficit for a long time, and we've actually seen platinum itself moving into a surplus situation, or at least predicted to move into surplus for 2021. Rhodium and palladium still in deficit, but I don't know. I get the sense that you need to see a solid recovery in vehicle production, number one. Obviously, auto catalytic converters are also absolutely key consumers of the PGM basket. And unless you see that, I think they're going to be a little bit subdued. Of course, whenever you're looking at a commodity company, a platinum company like Impala, you're going to be subject to the fluctuating currencies and fluctuating commodity prices. So you need the commodity price to play ball. I think the other risk around the sector is that we're getting to the stage where, you know, there is a sense that even if Impala doesn't increase its production dramatically, you might see increases coming from Amplats or Sibanye that might limit the, just put a lid on PGM prices, which is going to feed into the stock prices as well. So I think what the other players in the market also do is a little bit of a concern around just bringing on too much supply given the current environment.
Yeah. What about consolidation now in the sector, Ashraf? Because like I say, Impala Platinum may not have been able to hook an RB Plat, but Tami highlighting very specifically that they can continue to acquire quality assets globally because of the health of the balance sheet right now.
Yeah, they could either acquire or they could hand back the cash, which is always the debate that directors have at this point in a cycle. I do think that you will see a rise in the price of the PGM basket, but I don't think that's sustainable. I don't think it lasts beyond the next 6 to 18 months. You know, touching on Gary's point about catalytic converters, yes, we will still have ICE engines for the next decade. However, demand is going to start falling off as we convert to electric vehicles.
Yeah. Before we go offshore, I want to take a quick look at another local stock very quickly. While I say local stock, Rowan Williams highlighting that when it comes to Supergroup, people forget sometimes that it's somewhat of a rand hedge. Take a listen.
They have quite significant operations in Australia, UK, Europe and South Africa. So I think what people forget sometimes, it is somewhat of a rand hedge. About 60% of earnings are non-South Africa based. And they have a large stock of used cars as well. We've seen supply chain disruptions. That's in their lease business in Australia. So a lot of potential stock profits there to be had. The dealerships are also doing very well, notwithstanding some supply shortages. Again, their stock of second-hand cars in the dealerships are doing well. Those are also well-run businesses. We are seeing an increase in demand.
Ashraf, when I look at Supergroup, I almost forget that it's got this second-hand vehicle sales market, because you think of it as a logistics play more so than anything else. So let's put those two segments that it operates in into the spotlight and what's holding it in good stead right now.
Well, I think the motor vehicle sales have certainly helped it over the past 12 months, especially with demand in the UK, Europe, as well as to some extent Australia. And globally, second-hand sales have done exceptionally well, with the discounts relative to new car prices being fairly narrow. In fact, I'm told it's the narrowest it's been in almost 30 years. So I think Supergroup has definitely benefited from that. Logistically, I think they will continue to benefit, and we'll see upside in overall revenue growth for the group.
Yeah. What are you anticipating out of a Supergroup, Gary? I mean, how are you viewing this play right now? To be honest, it's not a company that we put the spotlight on very often.
Well, I suppose if you look at the stock price, it languishes with a lot of the other kind of South African mid cap stocks, in that it's actually underperformed the All Share Index over the last 5 years, fairly dramatically. I mean, it's looking at it, it's actually down 17%, over a 5 year period. But, that maybe doesn't tell the story of the company correctly, because as so many of our kind of smaller mid cap companies, they just don't seem to achieve the right valuations. Historically, it's trading on an earnings multiple of about 11 times. And looking forward, you know, it does look like we're going to see a little bit of a kick up in revenue growth for the next period. So the estimate is for around a 15% revenue growth. That's been dropping off to kind of high mid single digits, 2 and 3 years out. So I think the growth profile of the business is quite good. As everyone has highlighted, it's not just the South Africa play. Only it's 49% of 2021 revenue comes from Africa, not even South Africa, and the balance is made up then by the UK and Australia. Australia at 10% and the UK at just a touch under 30%. So it does offer that rand hedge component. And, if you do see a re-rating in our kind of small and mid-cap sector to more accurately, I think, reflect what is going on in the underlying businesses, and you start seeing people, especially in a high inflation environment, moving towards a more value-orientated approach to investing, you could see significant gains out of the share price. So on the face of it, it's not one that we we hold in the portfolio. Unfortunately, it doesn't fit within our mandate, but it does look interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's take a look now at a platform of a different kind, Shopify, a sales platform for small and medium-sized businesses in the U.S. This was Caroline Kremen's pick this week.
This is a sales platform for small and medium-sized businesses in the U.S. Essentially what it does is offers a plug-and-play payment program, so the guys don't really have to develop their own payment system. It is the second largest next to Amazon payment system in the U.S. 50% of its merchants are in the U.S., but it's expanding rapidly across the globe. Even if you look at some of South Africa's little small, mid-sized businesses who, you know, want to sell through e-commerce, you know, they're starting to use Shopify. Now, small and mid-sized businesses have been kind of late to the e-commerce market, but it is growing rapidly. It's a nice time to buy now because they came out of Q3 results, which disappointed. You don't often get the opportunity to pick this up.
Q3 results that disappointed, though, Ashraf, and that's the that's what stands out a little bit for investors right now. So how optimistic are you about how quickly that starts to turn around?
Well, so, you know, what's the definition of Q3 results disappointing?
It depends instead of where making your bar of expectations been set.
Well, you know, if they say earnings growth of 35% and they come in with 30% earnings growth, that's a disappointment. In fact, in the U.S., that's a huge disappointment. And I think that's, you know, that's what we are seeing. Sure, people are coming off e-commerce to some extent because things are opening up in the U.S. Things are opening up, in fact, globally. So purchasing through the likes of Shopify and Amazon, etc., is going to come down. But I think longer term, the trend is to purchase through e-commerce. And look at the Farfetch Richemont deal that was, the discussions that was announced today. That's just an indication of where the trend is and what the market sees for the next 5 years.
Okay. On a valuation basis, Gary, a good time to pick some Shopify up?
What are your valuation basis? These are one of these crazy expensive US tech stocks. So when you're sitting on a last 12 months earning multiple of 55 times. So you're taking 55 years worth of earnings to get it back. So get back your initial investment. So yeah, pretty hefty, pretty expensively priced. But you know, again, with so many of these tech companies, it's not about the earnings necessarily. It's about what they offer and what obviously the future holds. Now we are starting to get very concerned about the very extended tech plays. But Shopify is interesting because Shopify offers you essentially a platform. It already makes up around, you know, in the e-commerce space, its platform makes up around 29% of the market share in terms of sales. So, you know, competing against established marketplaces like Amazon, it has the advantage that allows individual small shop owners to, you know, maintain their brand. But it's also easier to facilitate the transactions than like going and using a website builder like Wix or trying to build on WordPress and use a WooCommerce plugin or something like that. It makes it very easy for small and medium businesses to sell their goods. And that business model has stood at an incredible state, enough that it is capturing a significant portion of e-commerce sales. So does that then justify a 55x earnings multiple? It's really difficult to say in tech. And I think it comes down to your kind of personal risk tolerance, whether you want to go into something like this. We don't hold it in portfolios, but and like I said, we're starting to get concerned about some of these very, very expensive kind of platform businesses. There's obviously a lot of regulation coming around them as well, and I think the moats aren't quite as deep as people expect, and if we do enter a high inflation environment, you're going to see a very, very quick shift of value. So I think just be cautious, but yeah, there's no question. I mean, over the last 5 years, 3,200% returns are certainly a lot of momentum.
Absolutely. Well, Caroline, of course, saying that that's where she's finding the opportunity in the tech space right now, which has, of course, run pretty hard over the past year. Carl Hebers, instead, give a shifting focus a little bit to a sector and a company that's been under pressure, but that's likely to see some upside start to come into play now, Hexcel Group.
Obviously, been under pressure with the aircraft demand being low, with the airlines not flying as much as they have been, or, you know, in the past. But we believe it'll recover, or that industry will recover. And as we've seen with the BA story already, increasing number of flights. So over time, there'll be a recovery in the aircraft required. ROE historically has been between 18 and 20% for Hexcel. In 2020, it was 2%, so you can just see if it reverts even close to historic levels, there's quite a bit of recovery. That is a recovery of a very high-quality stock or company that it would be a good buy now.
As you both will know by now, because we've been doing this show long enough, I've left 30 seconds at the end for you to provide comment on this last stock. Ashraf, let's start off with you. Hexcel, are you convinced in the kind of recovery that we're going to see come through, and is now the time to delve in?
You know, I am convinced that there's going to be a recovery. It will last 2 to 3 years. People definitely want to be out there. So, yes, I would say buy it, but buy it with that view.
Okay. On your side, Gary?
I think, yes, there will be a recovery. There's no question about that, but it's how much of that recovery is already priced into the stock. So it, being an offshore company, it's got a fairly decent analyst coverage. So you're getting quite nice price discovery and good estimates from at least good consensus estimates. 2 years out, they're expecting around a 20% revenue recovery and a 437% earnings recovery. So you've got to remember that's already baked into the stock price. If you actually look at the spread of analysts that are covering it, and there's a decent amount of them. So you're looking at 19 institutional level analysts covering it. Only 4 have buys on it, 10 have holds on it, and 5 have sells. The implied upside with their price targets is -4% from here. So for me, I would probably be remaining cautious.
Okay, well, let's leave it there. Always a pleasure, gentlemen. Thanks so much for having joined us on the line, of course, Gary and Ashraf there. And with that, we've come to the end of this week's Stockwatch. We'll see you again, same time, same place, next week.